This video is sponsored by Squarespace. More about them in just a moment.
You sent me the worst philosophy takes that you have ever heard so that I can force myself to defend them. So, let's get started. My name is Joe Folley, and this is Unsolicited Advice. Right, here we have a bad take from @DishwaterGremlin, and it reads, "It doesn't directly affect you, so why should you care?" This one grinds my gears for a multitude of reasons. Oftentimes, people who say this choose to ignore the areas where it does in fact directly affect you or them. They fail to recognize that it indirectly affecting you does still affect you, or they fail to recognize the idea of having empathy and compassion for others who it does directly affect. There's a lot going on there. I mean, this person's leveled three critiques at it. One is that just a factual one, that they might be mistaken about what directly affects them. The other is that it might indirectly affect you and that still concerns you. And then thirdly, that caring about what directly affects others could be, you know, a good thing in and of itself, right? You know, we like to encourage sort of empathy when we're making ethical decisions. If I see someone stabbed on the street and then I just walk past them, basically going, "Oh, it's just not my problem, man," we would tend to frown upon that. If you're going to try and defend this position that the things that don't directly affect you, you shouldn't care about, or that it's permissible not to care about them, right? Because those are two different points. There's a difference between saying that this doesn't affect you, so you shouldn't care, and saying this doesn't affect you, so you're not obliged to care. And you might think that one of those is defensible, but the other one isn't. One potential way that you could try and defend this position in some form would be to attempt to make a reductio ad absurdum of a rule like, if something directly affects someone else, even if it doesn't directly affect you, then you should care about it, right? Because these other two critiques that Dishwasher Gremlin raises, I think that they're perfectly fine critiques. They're not necessarily philosophical critiques, right? Like, someone being mistaken in what affects them doesn't necessarily mean that they were wrong to think that if something didn't affect them, then they shouldn't care about it or aren't obliged to care about it. One way you could defend that conditional philosophically would be to try and stretch the inverse of it to its extreme. So I think your best bet at doing this is going to be to give something like Peter Singer's argument in Famine, Poverty, and Affluence, right? I think that's the title. I occasionally just forget one of the words to it, but I'm pretty sure it's Famine, Affluence, and Poverty, or Famine, Poverty, and Affluence, or one of them. The argument he makes there is that there is no moral distinction between walking past a drowning child and choosing not to go in and rescue them because you're worried about ruining your new shoes, and making a luxury purchase and thus choosing not to spend that money donating to an effective charity that will then use that money to actually save lives in the world. So one critique people have leveled at that Singerian argument is that it is too morally demanding. It makes moral demands of people that they cannot possibly hope to fulfill. And it's thought that a minimal criterion of an effective moral or ethical system is that people can fulfill it without unreasonably damaging their own lives or something like that. Or at the very least, it is questionable whether Singer's criteria are realistic, is one way to kind of put that criticism. And if you endorse that criticism, well, then you could say something like, look, if we open the door to it being obligatory to care about things even if they don't affect you, how are we going to stop this runaway train where all of a sudden we're all awful people just because we're not donating all of our excess income to malaria charities or something like that? Of course, you can respond to that by just biting the Singerian bullet and saying, yeah, I actually do think that most people are profoundly immoral, myself included, right? That's one direction you can take that. And I think that's fine, right? You're allowed to bite philosophical bullets. In which case, yeah, you can absolutely say, no, you are obliged to care for what directly affects other people, even if it doesn't affect you at all. In practice, most people don't live like that, though. I certainly don't, and I don't have that strong of a response to Singer's argument. So we can give that reply, but we might be setting ourselves up for quite a lot of extra moral obligation, and a lot of people aren't willing to swallow that, and very few people enact it in practice. I think that the most defensible form of, if it doesn't directly affect you, why do you care, is to just go for that permissibility thing, right? To say that, okay, you might not be morally obliged to care, but it's not a bad thing to care, right? You shouldn't be discouraged from caring about other people. You can also critique that, why should you care about anyone other than yourself, effectively, by saying that there are certain types of people in relation to you who you have a special duty towards, right? The classic example of this is your children. We tend to think that parents have special duties towards their children that they don't have towards people who aren't their children, right? That's something happening to your child. Obviously, it will affect you, but let's just abstract away and say that for whatever reason it doesn't affect you. We would still say, okay, you seem like you're obliged to care about that, for that to affect your actions in some way. That might allow you to cut a middle path between this quite excessively individualistic picture of, oh, like, I've just got me, and if it doesn't affect me, then at least I'm not obliged to care in any way, shape, or form, and this very onerous Singerian position, which suggests that we are all falling short of our fundamental moral duties in really quite excessively serious ways. So I think that your best bet, if you're trying to defend the it doesn't affect me so I don't care line, would be to try and paint the alternative as something absurd. And I think your best response to that would be to try and revise that position so that you're not obliged to care for literally every bad thing that happens in the world, which would arguably be a kind of moral paralytic, but you are obliged to care for a few things, maybe. Of course, the reply to that is to say, well, why should you care about your own family more than other people's, especially if, say you are spending $300 on your child. That you might be fulfilling some kind of special parental duty towards that. The Singerian response would be to say something like, okay, let's say that you do have some kind of special parental duty here that does morally matter in some way. Is the parental duty so important? Is it so morally important that, say, you're buying your child some new shoes for $300? That overrides saving a child's life, how that money could elsewhere be used, if that makes sense. I think that it is genuinely quite difficult to single out your exact duties towards different people in plausible ethical frameworks, but, you know, moral philosophy is hard. But yeah, that would be, I think, your best bet of defending this position would be to try and paint the alternative as absurd. Whether you're successful in that, I suppose would be some kind of open question. And of course, it's always open to the other person to bite the bullet and say, yes, absolutely, we do have vast moral duties that 99.999% of us are failing. But before moving on, I just want to take a quick moment to thank today's sponsor, Squarespace. If you're looking to build a website, then you know it can be a real hassle. First, you have to choose a domain name and then design the whole thing. And there's always this underlying fear that you're messing up and creating something that doesn't just look untidy, but actually seems unprofessional. But this is where Squarespace comes into play. They take all of that headache and complexity and they compress it down into a single platform, using ready-made templates to take all of the stress out of website building. Their block-based Fluid Engine editing system is also so easy to use and makes it simple to integrate anything you want into your website without having to master an elaborate coding language. Head to squarespace.com/unsolicitedadvice and use the code unsolicitedadvice to get 10% off your first purchase of a website or a domain name. Thank you to Squarespace for sponsoring this video, and let's get back to the bad takes. Okay, next up we have a bad take by Based Neat New Order, and it reads, being depressed just means you're closer in touch with the horrors of existence. So this actually is a position that I feel like a lot of people hold, and how defensible it is going to depend on what you think existence is like, right? Someone like Schopenhauer arguably could have this position, right? Because under his view of reality, reality itself is sort of infused with suffering. To remind everyone, I'm not going to go into his kind of metaphysics here because that's complicated. His picture of the human will is that the human will is forever striving to be fulfilled, but never is actually fulfilled. Because as soon as you obtain an object of your desires, your mind will immediately, well, your will will immediately conjure up another one for you to pursue instead. And thus, almost the defining characteristic of the human experience is to be unhappy and dissatisfied. If you just left his philosophy there and you ignored the kind of sketch solutions that he has to do with aesthetic experience and the abnegation of the will and stuff like that, you could build an argument there that would suggest that the more aware that you are of that, the harder your life might be. I mean, arguably, this is a position that Emil Cioran sometimes takes up, though as ever with Cioran, it's difficult quite to tell how tongue-in-cheek he's being. But certainly at points, you know, He seems to suggest that he thinks the more you are aware of the pessimistic state of reality, the less happy you're going to be. That life, passionate, enjoyable life, is sustained by illusions and fictions and having your eyes closed to a certain extent to the way that reality really is. I don't know Mainlander enough to know how well that coheres with his position. I'm still kind of wrestling with the philosophy of redemption, about 250-odd pages through it. So yeah, so I can't tell if Mainlander, how much Mainlander coheres with that. But from what I've heard, Mainlander shares some similarities with that conception. So that would be the way that you could defend this position. You would have to argue directly that the horrors of existence are there and that being more aware of them is going to make you more depressed or sadder. Of course, even then, it doesn't follow that just because you are depressed or sad, that means that you are closer in touch with the horrors of existence. That conditional wouldn't follow from that. You know, you could, in theory, be depressed or sad over all sorts of illusory things, even if it were the case that the base layer of existence was genuinely pessimistic. I think the kind of cultural myth, I guess, I want to say myth, is that the cleverer you are, or the more intelligent you are, the sadder you're going to be, because of this supposed pessimistic underlying nature of reality. I think we can learn a lot from pessimistic philosophers. I don't necessarily think that that is always what they're getting at. I think that's a kind of cultural idea rather than an idea that's actually found in Schopenhauer or Choran. Choran doesn't say that the cleverer you are, the less happy you'll be. Choran says the more aware you are of these pessimistic conclusions, potentially the less happy that you'll be. Although he does find pessimistic joys, like in this kind of detached, semi-ironic way that Choran often does. That, I think is pretty indefensible. I mean, you know, there might be some kind of loose correlation there, but I just don't see any reason why somebody being cleverer would lead to them being less happy. I think that oftentimes, and this is just me speculating here, but I think that sometimes people think that they are less happy because of their intelligence or their cleverness or something, because the particular suffering they might be going through might be related to their intelligence or being clever, right? Like, I once met someone in university, I didn't know them very well, but they would quite often say that they thought that them being clever and having to think things through and having to, you know, having this, as they put it, kind of heightened awareness of the world around them and reality. And they're a very clever, much, much cleverer than me. So, like, I'm not suggesting that they're necessarily wrong about this. That was the root cause behind their misery. And they made the argument that if they were less intelligent, they might be happier. And my reply to them was that it's, you know, technically invalid to infer from the fact that a given thing is causing your unhappiness now that if you were to get rid of that cause, there wouldn't be another cause coming to replace it, if that makes sense, right? So, like, you know, say this person who considered that their intelligence was ultimately the cause of their unhappiness suddenly became much stupider or something like that, right? I mean, this guy was really, really, really clever, at least as far as I could tell. So let's say we knock like 80 IQ points off him. How do we know that he wouldn't still be unhappy, but there would just be a different cause behind it? Or that he has misidentified the cause of his unhappiness? I don't think we're all that good at identifying the root causes behind why we feel a certain way. I'll give you an example of this the other day, right? So I've mentioned on the channel before, I like not to go on about it too much, but I've got a chronic pain condition, so I'm in pain most of the time. And it was actually embarrassingly recently that I realized how often when I'm in a bad mood or I'm like upset with someone or angry, I'm just in pain and I am misidentifying the cause of my discomfort as this external thing, this person that might be irritating me or something like that. And the natural fact, it just has a straightforward physical cause. That's the thing that if you were to remove it, the bad mood would go away. And so I imagine that there are a fair amount of people whereby this notion that they have that their intelligence or cleverness is causing their unhappiness, they may just be misidentifying the cause behind their unhappiness. And I think that's very plausible just because I think that we're often quite bad at identifying the causes of our unhappiness and just generally the causes of our mental and emotional states, right? Like, ever since I noticed this thing about my pain, I've been paying attention or trying to pay as close attention as possible to where actually do my feelings come from? Do they emerge based on the post hoc story that I tend to give to them? Or do they emerge from something some other third cause, often a far less dignified cause, and a far less rational cause, that I've just overlooked because I'm trying to flatter myself that my emotions are sensible, as opposed to the result of rather strange and chaotic factors. And maybe this is just me. Maybe other people are far more rational and reasonable than I am. But I certainly have found that quite a lot of the time, that post hoc story I tell myself is a very flattering picture of what seems on closer inspection to actually be going on. So if you do feel like, you know, your intelligence is making life worse for you, that may be the case. But I would encourage you to explore other potential explanatory avenues for that. But yeah, anyway, getting back to this point, I think your best bet for defending this take would be to just give a positive argument for a pessimistic structure to reality. And if you want to do that, yeah, you've got Schopenhauer, you've got Charan, you've got Mainlander, you've got Ligotti. I should make a video on Ligotti at some point. I need to reread some of his stuff because it's been a long time. But that's besides the point. Anyway, moving on. Next up, we have a take from Fan of Music, and it reads, "If everything is predetermined at a fundamental level that cannot be controlled or manipulated, then murderers should never be punished. Who are we to judge what could never be changed? In fact, you could argue that putting a murderer in prison is a worse crime against nature than the murder itself." I do occasionally see this position advanced. I don't necessarily think this actually is the position that's taken by Robert Sapolsky in Determined, but I have seen people say this online at the very least. This idea that there is no way of salvaging any kind of justification for punishment or even a minimal kind of moral responsibility if you don't have libertarian free will. So free will as an undetermined agential cause. I just don't necessarily think it follows. I mean, for one thing, the obvious response that you could give is just to say, well, us punishing them was determined as well, so there's no way of getting out of it either way. I suppose I don't necessarily like that response just because having information does change how an agent acts, right? Plausibly, if you were to believe that the punishment was unjustified, that would change how you act, right? So it wouldn't necessarily take the bite out of the incompatibilist, I suppose, let's call them for want of a better term, the incompatibilist argument here. It would just roll that argument into the general causal chain of history. I do think that the best way to defend this is to say something like, look, it is never right to punish someone based on something that they could not help but do. And under determinism, nobody can help what they do. Therefore, nobody is ever justified in being punished for what they do. Just honing on that punishment idea. Obviously, there are responses that people have given to this. It's a pretty minority position. And the most obvious response is that rectifying wrongs in this kind of retributive way that requires a thick sense of moral responsibility is not necessarily our only goal when it comes to quote-unquote punishment. Let's just take incarceration, right? So we often incarcerate, or sometimes incarcerate, people who we explicitly agree do not hold moral responsibility. Say someone has a deeply troubling mental illness and this causes them to act out erratically. Say they are have a very severe form of schizophrenia and that this makes them violent in some way. Though, to be clear, you know, on the whole, most people with schizophrenia actually aren't violent. But let's say that this person is, right? We institutionalize people, or section them, as it's called in the UK. We don't necessarily think it follows from that that person has moral responsibility for the actions, violent or otherwise, that they did when they were in this kind of psychotic state, again, for want of a better term. We tend to think, no, we're not sectioning you because we think you're a bad person. We're sectioning you because you are a danger, right? It's sectioning that person is no different from, say, defending against landslides or floods, right? It's just sort of you're saying, well, that it's not really clear that this person is acting from a kind of agential place, but nonetheless, we have a duty to protect the general population, and this person is a threat to them, even if it's not their fault, however you want to cash that term out. So we're going to isolate them, and it's not necessarily as punishment, but it is as containment. Another argument you might make is, look, it's not this murderer's fault that they committed a murder in the sense that they couldn't have done otherwise, but we can intervene in their causal chain in order to change their mental properties and thus cause them to act differently in the future, which would be a kind of reformation-based argument for imprisonment, for example. The other thing that you could say, and this would be a much less minimal way of responding to the idea that nobody should ever be punished for their actions, would be to say something like, look, when we assign someone moral responsibility, we're not interested in whether they have total free will or not. That's not why we're doing it. We're doing it because when we think of people, we need to construct little models of them in our minds in order to predict and anticipate behavior. And we assign people properties based on how efficiently it will predict or, predict or explain their behavior. If somebody acts in a way that is congruous with the rest of their actions and is also violent and antisocial, then that makes sense to assign that property of violence and antisociality to the model of them that we have in our minds. In other words, this kind of argument would deny that it is necessary for someone to be punished that they could do otherwise. This would say, look, when we assign moral responsibility to someone, it's not about whether they could do otherwise. It's about whether they, as an agent — you can still have conceptions of agents, even on a deterministic framework — it's about whether they, as an agent, has been the cause of this crime, right? They could still be a predetermined cause, but they could just be the proximate cause. There is plausibly a difference, even on a determinist framework, between a causal chain that runs outside of someone's will and a causal chain that runs through someone's will. So you could justify punishment by saying, well, no, the causal chains that run through someone's will, through someone's agency, determined agency though it may be, is the marker of moral responsibility rather than libertarian-style metaphysical heavyweight free will. That's the other way that I've seen people defend it. That's very big in compatibilist circles. And I do think that makes a certain sort of sense, especially if you consider that it's not entirely clear that somebody having libertarian free will is sufficient to assign them moral responsibility, right? So say, for the sake of argument, we did live in a universe where libertarian free will held. Well, in that case, there are still scenarios where we deny that someone has moral responsibility, even though they could have done otherwise in this metaphysical sense. Say, in this libertarian world, somebody held a gun to someone's head and say, you know, steal that packet of biscuits or I will shoot you. There, we would tend to say that if that person committed the crime of stealing the packet of biscuits, they still wouldn't be morally responsible, because even though their choice here, you know, by hypothesis, wasn't determined, it still doesn't seem like that is sufficient for moral responsibility. Of course, you could still argue that it is necessary for moral responsibility, but then you'd be butting up against certain intuitive arguments that suggest that we can assign responsibility in a determined world. For example, you know, if there's this kind of hypothetical person called Jim, who, though all of their actions are determined, when he gets in front of the judge and the judge is like, I'm going to sentence you to prison, and Jim says, no, you ought not to, also says, look, I'm going to kill again. I really wanted to kill, and I did that. I did that because I wanted to. For a lot of people, I did that because I wanted to is sufficient to assign moral responsibility intuitively, even if the choice is determined. So there's a kind of clash of intuitions going on here. I think this is partly because most of our moral frameworks were crafted in an age where most people did believe in some form of libertarian free will, and now we're much more divided on this metaphysical point, and it's kind of an open question, and at least partly a rhetorical and emotional battle over to what extent our moral intuitions recalibrate or stay the same after this transition. I'm not necessarily saying that determinism will win out in the argument. I'm just saying that if it does, that will necessitate some kind of shift in moral frameworks, and it is an open question which one will take over. But again, like, that kind of analysis is deeply morally anti-realist and potentially even morally non-cognitivist in its underlying assumptions. So take the whole thing with a grain of salt, even more so than you should take everything I say with a grain of salt. Okay, our next purposefully bad take comes from Straight Jacket Fitness, and it simply reads, might makes right. So yeah, I think that if you're going to defend something like the position might makes right, you're best doing it as a descriptive thesis rather than a prescriptive one. For example, these are often run together when people are reading Nietzsche. In The Genealogy of Morals, Nietzsche famously gives an analysis of morality whereby people and types of people create moral systems that allow them to express their own strength to the fullest extent, if that makes sense. That's a kind of complex notion, but for just the purposes of this video, we can think about it as a little bit like types of people will craft morality that is in their quote-unquote best interest. And this is a descriptive type of might makes right thesis. Nietzsche is literally trying to give a descriptive account of how certain moral codes came to be, based on the type of people that crafted them. So as part of his analysis of the rise of slave morality, he points out that it was in the less powerful class's best interests to create values that would stifle the attempts of the more powerful to oppress them, or that would encourage the more powerful to take pity on them, and moreover, would evaluate them as good for not having power in the first place, and also pretending that it was kind of a free choice that they had in any case. That, again, is a merely descriptive thesis, right? Nietzsche goes through how kind of master morality or noble morality comes about, which is, again, a descriptive thesis about how the most powerful class, so to speak, naturally affirm and endorse their own qualities, which are things like power and strength and a whole bunch of other stuff that we don't need to get into. So again, that is a descriptive account. Nietzsche doesn't even necessarily endorse master or noble morality. He thinks that people can learn from it. But one of the things that he critiques it for is for being kind of stupid or unsophisticated. The nobles in Nietzsche's analysis have organized wills in the sense that their wills are all pointing in one direction. They're not devolving or degrading. But at the same time, they're not particularly complicated, not particularly sophisticated. In fact, it is partly their own unsophistication that then allows them to fall under the spell of slave morality when it is advanced as another value system. Again, it's all much more complicated than this, but again, we're just kind of simplifying here to give an idea that there are descriptive accounts of might makes right that have been advanced, and I think are not necessarily like totally implausible, right? It's not an implausible thesis that those who have the power or are in a position to forge moralities, even though, of course, for Nietzsche, forging morality is not a conscious process. It's at least as much, and probably much more so, an unconscious one. But in any case, that it's not necessarily absurd to think that the people who are crafting these moral values might craft them in their own best interests, where best interests here is cashed out as giving them the chance to most fully express and expand their own power. Again, power is kind of a term of art here. I don't think if Nietzsche was a very good example to kind of give a 2-minute summary of. But anyway, that is a descriptive thesis of might makes right. But it's also clear that Nietzsche is not simply endorsing this descriptive story, right? Because otherwise, this is a question I think a lot of people have when they read The Genealogy of Morals, which is that if Nietzsche is endorsing a prescriptive idea of might makes right, why is he not pro-slave morality? Because slave morality is the most dominant force. It is the one that has overcome its obstacle. And I think the reason for this is that Nietzsche's normative, or I say normative rather than prescriptive, but Nietzsche's normative component isn't simply might makes right. It's much more complicated and also really hotly debated. But at the very least, it can't be as simple as whoever is most powerful and whatever type of person is most powerful gets to, in this strong normative sense, dictate morality. Like, that may be what in practice happens, but Nietzsche clearly thinks that slave morality is in some sense bad, right? He calls it a disaster. Again, that's an example of how the descriptive and normative component of might makes right can quickly fall apart. The other thing is that the trouble with a prescriptive idea of might makes right, like you're actually saying that whoever is most powerful is by definition correct, is that that means that morality is going to change pretty quickly, depending on who's in power, right? I mean, in Plato's Republic, Thrasymachus puts forward an account of morality that is whatever is just is what is good for the most powerful. And like, at least to me, it is not overwhelmingly clear whether in that dialogue Thrasymachus is putting this forward as a prescriptive thesis or a descriptive thesis. The character of Socrates takes it as a prescriptive thesis. I don't know. It seems like it's much more plausibly advanced as a descriptive thesis. And I privately wonder whether there has been some kind of maybe straw manning done on Plato's part when recording or constructing this dialogue. But at the very least, you know, I think that the most plausible version of Might Makes Right is a descriptive thesis. I think the prescriptive version is just pretty hard to defend. You have to kind of specify what might makes right would mean in a prescriptive way, right? Is it, you know, Thrasymachus says it's what's good for the most powerful, but then it's like, who gets to decide what's good for the most powerful? Do the most powerful get to decide? Well, we can be mistaken about what's good for us. And it gets really quite complicated. You know, when you try and cash out such a simple phrase, things can fall apart quite quickly, as I think Socrates does pretty well demonstrate in The Republic. My point is that if the most defensible version of this is a descriptive thesis, and probably the less defensible version of this is a prescriptive thesis. And yeah, I don't know any moral philosopher who thinks that might makes right is a good grounding for an ethical system. I'm not convinced that it would even work very well. And it is worth noting that when Nietzsche's giving his descriptive account of might makes right, it isn't necessarily that the mighty end up acting in their own interests, or the people with power do end up acting in their own interests. It, you know, slave morality eventually kind of comes round and bites a lot of people on the arse. So I don't know. Nonetheless, I do think that the descriptive version is probably the most defensible, and the prescriptive version is much, much harder to defend. Nonetheless, both will eventually, if they're going to be defensible, even in the slightest, will have to get down to brass tacks and give a detailed account of how exactly they're cashing out all of the unspecified terms in this statement. But anyway, moving on. Right, next up we have a deliberately bad take from Wes Roberts 2032, and it reads, "Not an explicit take I've heard, but an implicit one. Morality is relative, which means it's objectively true that it's morally wrong to criticize the moral beliefs of others." So I touched upon this a little bit in my video on moral relativism, which is that oftentimes this, it's generally called a kind of principle of tolerance or a tolerance principle or something like that, is often advanced in popular discussions around moral relativism. The idea that if there are genuinely incommensurable moral universes that do not cross over, then one moral universe doesn't have standing from the point of view of another moral universe to critique that moral universe. And kind of vaguely out of this idea, a principle of moral tolerance emerges, whereby people are encouraged not to look down upon or judge other moralities because they're, in a sense, living in a different moral universe. But it is worth noting that when you read, or when I've read, academic moral relativists defending a moral relativist position, they don't tend to say that. In fact, they tend to be trying to explicitly deny that you can't do moral critique under moral relativism in this way, partly because, of course, that would plausibly be a real problem for the moral relativist. One of the big things that we want to do with moral and ethical frameworks is to critique other moral and ethical frameworks. If we can't do that, then we lose quite a lot of what we seem to be getting at with the machinery of moral talk. And so quite a lot of moral relativists are interested in explicitly denying that it follows from moral relativism that it's wrong to critique the moral beliefs of others. This isn't a hard thing for them to do, right? Because, well, it's a hard thing for them to do in one way, and it's an easy thing for them to do in another way. You can just kind of hand wave the principle of tolerance and say, like, well, obviously it doesn't follow that it's morally wrong to critique another moral system from moral relativism, because if all moral truths are relative, then that must also be couched within a moral system, right? You can't go around saying it is objectively, as in, you know, trans framework objectively wrong to critique other moral systems if your point is that there are no trans framework moral truths. That just kind of, it just doesn't follow, right? So that's one way that you can deal with this response or deal with this idea as a moral relativist. However, again, to steelman this take, the principle of tolerance, or at least this feeling of tolerance that appears for many people to not so much follow from moral relativism, but to kind of naturally fall out of moral relativism, is that does it, in some respect, take the bite out of your own moral critique once you recognize that you're only ever critiquing someone else from your own standpoint, and that whatever values you and your society happen to have simply do not necessarily apply to those people. They're not necessarily affirmed by those people. So extreme moral relativism does deny you a kind of shared basis on which you and a totally incommensurable moral community could have a rationally resolvable disagreement. So I think that's where it kind of falls out of it, right? But there's an implicit assumption there, which is that in order to morally condemn something, it has to be done from a standpoint-free position. And that's highly questionable, right? Is it the case that if you saw someone currently committing a murder, you would take offense to that because you think that it is objectively wrong? Or would you just say, no, like, it is enough that it goes against my values and it is this sense of moral indignation and anger is arising from me. And that's the bit that means that I'm motivated to then go and try and prevent the murder or otherwise morally condemn the murder, right? So I think that it depends. The kind of loose principle of tolerance does fall out of moral relativism if you think that you do need a standpoint-free position in order to critique a moral system, because moral relativism just denies that that exists. But I would suggest that most moral relativists, or at least most moral relativists that I've read, just deny that that is a criterion that you need to fulfill if you're going to do moral critique. And I can totally understand that, right? Because I kind of don't think that I do try, or I don't think that I do necessarily attempt to adopt a standpoint-free position when I'm doing kind of moral critique or just instinctive moral outrage, right? It seems like it's quite intimately bound up with my standpoint and my particular psychological constitution. In fact, I'm not really sure whether any kind of metaphysics is involved there at all, at least not in my motivations. You might think that I would need a kind of standpoint-free perspective in order to justify my indignation, and that's fine. But in practice, I don't think that many people need that in order to feel moral indignation. So yeah, and there are two ways you can attack this, right? One is to say that the principle of tolerance under true moral relativism is just self-contradictory. It asserts that there are perspective-free moral laws. Don't criticize the beliefs or moral beliefs of those in an incommensurable moral set to your own. That's just contradictory. There's no real salvaging that. And the second would be to say that if you take this much more modest kind of tolerance principle advanced through moral relativism, which is to say that in order to critique another moral society's view, you would need to have a standpoint-free zone, and you can't have that, so there is no rational basis on which to critique another moral community's set of moral beliefs, well, then you can respond to that by saying that that's not a precondition for critiquing someone else's moral beliefs or another society's moral beliefs. You can say, well, yeah, you just critique it from your own standpoint, right? Like, there's nothing necessarily wrong with that, at least not on its face. This is something that you see a lot more with popular discussions around moral relativism than you do in academic ones. Quite a lot of academics, if they do argue for a principle of tolerance, it's normally not saying that it's morally wrong to criticize the moral beliefs of others. It's normally something much, much more nuanced than that. So David Wong argues for a principle of tolerance. But again, it's not saying that it's morally wrong to criticize the moral beliefs of others. He has quite a sophisticated framework, and it's a much looser kind of tolerance than this kind of total tolerance that you sometimes see in popular discussions of moral relativism, which in practice, like, people just don't believe in, right? It's certainly not how they act in the world. So I think this is a pretty indefensible position to hold, at least in the crude form that it's put here. You can get to some principle of tolerance that's sort of justified by a moral relativist stance, but it's not total, and it's normally pretty circumscribed in its scope. But anyway, moving on. Okay, that's all we have time for today. If you want to check out the previous entries in this Bad Take series, you can watch them right here. Thank you so much for watching, and have a wonderful day.